Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books and Philosophy channel of the New Books Network. My name is Robert Talese. I am professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the channel with Carrie Figder. Carrie is associate professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. Today, I'll be talking to Tom Brooks about his new book, Punishment, which has recently been published by Routledge. Brooks is reader in law at Durham Law School and associate in philosophy at Durham University. Social stability and justice require that we live together according to rules, and this in turn means that the rules must be enforced. Accordingly, we sometimes see fit to punish those who break the rules. Hence, society features a broad system of institutions by which we punish. But there's a deep and long-standing philosophical disagreement over what precisely punishment is for. The standard views are easy to anticipate. Some say that we punish in order to give offenders what they deserve. Others claim that we punish in order to encourage others to obey the rules. Still others see punishment as a process of rehabilitating offenders. Recent theorists have attempted to combine these standard views in various ways, and so the debates go on. In his new book, Tom Brooks reviews these leading debates and makes a compelling case for a distinctive theory of punishment that he calls the unified theory. Brooks contends that the unified theory can embrace several highly intuitive penal goals while avoiding the philosophical difficulties confronting each of the competing theories of punishment. But can one theory do it all? Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Tom Brooks.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm magnificent. How are you, Bob?
Oh, I'm doing fine. Thank you so much for joining us on New Books in Philosophy.
A real pleasure.
Well, folks, today my guest on New Books in Philosophy is Tom Brooks. His new book is titled Punishment, and it's just out with Routledge. This book is to be recommended because it successfully manages two objectives, which are not easily synthesized. That is, Punishment, the book, is at once an engaging survey of the leading debates and issues concerning the nature and purposes of punishment, while it's also at the same time an articulation and a defense of Brooks's own distinctive view of punishment, a view that he calls the unified theory of punishment. So it's at once a sort of introduction to the field and a substantive philosophical defense of a particular view within it. The book is also, I think, to be recommended because it does a very nice job, I thought, of combining sort of philosophical and conceptual matters with empirical questions about the data concerning crime and punishment, imprisonment, recidivism, and these sorts of things. So it's a quite engaging read and a real nice entree into the field, but it's also got plenty to offer those who are already working in the field. So there's a lot to talk about, folks. But Tom, why don't you start us off in our usual way by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Right. I came to philosophy in perhaps a different than usual way, or follow a different than usual path. I'm originally from New Haven, Connecticut, although have lived in a couple of countries, including the Republic of Ireland and now the UK. I've lived in the UK for over 10 years now. And when I started along my academic path, you know, many of the academic philosophers I know originally studied philosophy as philosophy majors as undergraduates. But I instead started my career studying music. At the wonderful university, Bob, you'll know very well, called William Patterson.
Yes.
And where dreams come true. And when I was at William Patterson studying music, I became very interested in classical Indian music with a supervisor, Hugh Aiken, who I did not know at the time was an active member of the Hegel Society of America, which is an interesting thing I found out many years after I had left. So perhaps there were some seeds, philosophical seeds, put in my mind very early on. And when I got into Indian classical music, I was being advised that if I really wanted to kind of get to grips to this, I had to speak to someone at William Patterson who was a professor of government, who did Indian politics to kind of know a bit more about the ethics and the context of this wonderful stuff, Ravi Shankar and other stuff. And of course, Maya Chatter was her name, and she then tried to push me more to studying the politics surrounding, because many of the Indian classical music, many it's recanting stories or just in certain kinds of myths or other elements. And and this led to, originally, I had this kind of deep interest in Indian politics and culture. I then went to Arizona State University to study political science and had a supervisor who was from Bengal, who had himself done a PhD in philosophy, and convinced me that if I really wanted to come to grips with these kind of deeper contextual issues surrounding these things that I found so fascinating about Indian culture and politics. I have to say, this is one of the many things I've got very much in common with Martha Nussbaum. We both have a kind of deep interest in Indian culture and politics stuff, that I had to kind of engage with the Indian philosophical tradition. And that's when I became interested in that. But one of the problems that I had two, at least at this time. One was that in the world of political science, much of the way that political theory of philosophy was done was not just historical, but focused on some books of authors and not others. So you looked at some things written by Kant and not other works by Kant, some works by David Hume and not other works by Hume, and so on down the list. The other problem was that having an interest in Indian philosophy meant that I was talking about books and people that were wildly unfamiliar to other folks. And it was towards the end of my time in Arizona that I was introduced to the work of Hegel and British idealism. And what I found really interesting about this was it gave me people and a language that I could use that were more friendly to at least, you know, to the audiences around me, expressing kind of similar-ish kinds of ideas, but without having to give the unfamiliar names and so on. This led me to focus a bit more centrally on Hegel's ideas and Hegelian philosophy, and I went to University College Dublin to study for an MA in philosophy there. And it was at that time that I wrote my dissertation on the death penalty. It was the first time that whether or not it was just, and looking at different kinds of positions that one could argue for and defend in the debate that might reveal something new about it. And it was really the first time that I really started to get stuck into thinking about theories of punishment at that time. I then later did my PhD in philosophy at Sheffield University, focusing more on Hegel, but at that same time, my interest in punishment grew and developed, and to some extent, my interest in the subject of my book is very much has been there, as it were, as far back as my interest in Hegelianism and other things, is as far back as my interest in philosophy. And so since that time, I've worked for several years in a political science department at Newcastle University, and I'm now at Durham Law School teaching both jurisprudence, you know, philosophy of law, and also criminal law as well.
Well, that sounds like a pretty amazing journey.
Different. It's just different.
You know, it does. Maybe this is just a case of bad sampling, but it does strike me that there are a lot of philosophers who are interested in music, and in fact, the interest in music is somehow at the source of their interest in philosophy. I come across a lot of people who tell that kind of story, that somehow music was where they started. I think it's in the Phaedo that philosophy that Socrates says that philosophy is the best kind of music. But anyway,
I would surely agree with that. And there's other people, as you say, if not music, then maybe theater. I think Nussbaum, I think she started originally in theater or drama when she started her undergraduate studies at NYU. She didn't start in philosophy either. Jeff McMahon, I think, did literature as his first degree. So, you know, this idea of kind of arts broadly conceived has attracted a lot of philosophers. It's been a great conduit for people doing philosophy later on in their careers.
Yes. Something interesting there. But let's talk about the book, shall we?
Yes, please.
Sure. So let's begin where the book Punishment itself begins. So the book begins with an assessment and evaluation of the longstanding, we might say, traditional theories of punishment, retributivism, deterrence theories, rehabilitation views. You do a very nice job, I think, of laying out the central claims of each of these conceptions or theories of punishment, but you find each lacking. Could you run us through at least the major sort of traditional views and sort of sketch for us what the views are about and tell us where they're lacking? And I think this is an important part of talking about your book, because the unified theory, although it's not your view, although it's not an attempt to sort of synthesize all the theories of punishment, it is an attempt to synthesize different conceptions of what punishment is for. And so maybe getting different, getting the lay of the land would be a good place to start our discussion of the book. So please.
Yeah, great. So the book is in three parts. And the first part is on general theories. Part two will then, of course, consider hybrid theories. And then I end with some case studies. With the general theories, I'm looking at theories of punishment that have, as it were, you know, kind of one purpose that the theory is built around. One purpose for punishment, or one single justification, and these are, of course, the kind of classic views of punishment: retribution, deterrence, rehabilitation. Also, add another, restorative justice. I'll say something about in a moment. To take them each in turn, I did think it was very important, and I'm glad it came across, at least for you, and I hope for other readers, that I think it's important that when we survey the views that other people have, you know, there's this idea of having charity, in a sense, seeing things in their best light. The one purpose of this book was to kind of get clear on what people mean by these words, retribution and deterrence and other things, and unpack how often these are tense, encompassing many different views. But I thought it was important to say something about why people think this is attractive before showing why there might be some problems with how it conceives of itself, then later turning to, you know, what other kind of vision these people might find more attractive. Taking each in turn now, retribution, deterrence, rehabilitation, restorative justice. With retribution is, of course, the classic theory, often thought to be the oldest theory of punishment. It's understood in many different ways, perhaps the the most time honored, if there such a way of characterizing it, is the idea that offenders, criminals, should be punished because they deserve punishment, and to the degree they deserve punishment. Here, desert does an awful lot of work, and someone is deserving, roughly speaking. There's many ways to capture this and to cash this out, but roughly speaking, broadly, to deserve is to have a kind of moral responsibility for some wicked act, to do some kind of evil. And the thought is that people who are criminals should be punished because they do something bad, and the more bad it is, and of course assuming they're responsible for this badness, the more they should be punished. So the typical illustration, for example, taken from Immanuel Kant, is say, you know, the murderer is punished with death because you know, murder is a crime where the inner wickedness, the viciousness is physical. You can see it in the world. The evil is made real. You know, of course, on the one hand, this view has got has many adherents, in part because it gets, in some sense, many things, I think, right. One of the things I think it gets right is the idea that we ought never punish the innocent. So this idea that offenders must be deserving, they must have done something to warrant punishment. And also this idea that the thing that they did should have some kind of link with the treatment that they receive through punishment. So these ideas about desert and proportionality running through retribution has something attractive to it. And then when we think about cases of theft and we think about murder, we might say, look, you know, both of these kinds of crimes are bad things, they're evil things. Any just state we would imagine would, on balance, criminalize theft and murder. But they would also say that one would be should be punished more than the other. And retribution's answer is that the murderer is more deserving and they do something more bad in some sense. Where I think retribution runs into some trouble is that it runs with, and this is a problem that is not unique to retribution, but it's a problem that's particular to retribution as well, that it's dependent upon a wider framework of natural law jurisprudence that can be itself problematic. So it runs with this idea that we're in some sense punishing various acts of immorality. And of course, there's two issues with that. One is it's that kind of view is perhaps too wide in the sense that not all acts of that are immoral we punish. So telling white lies, you know, telling you, Bob, that we have a surprise birthday party for you or something like this. No one says that these kinds of things should be punished. So where do we set the threshold or not is an issue, I think, for this view. And the so I think it's too wide in that way. And also, in a sense, it got something else wrong, which is, in some sense, which moral view, which morality, what is the standard that we are to use in making these judgments? And not least because it's not clear that not all crimes you know, we don't punish all acts of immorality. Not all crimes are clearly immoral. So illegal parking and speeding perhaps could be, but I don't see why they necessarily are. And I think there's a problem here for retribution that I explore a lot more in the book. I call it a problem of amoral crimes. On deterrence, of course, is another view that has that's almost as old as retribution. Generally, the idea that the aim of punishment is to deter future offenders, has a long and proud tradition as well. Lots of people accept it because, of course, you know, deterrence also gets, you know, something I think that is right. And that is that when we're thinking about punishment and criminal justice, a criminal justice system that made crime more likely, that didn't enable crime reduction, would be, I think, really fundamentally problematic and hard to accept. And deterrence seems to get that truth right. The issues for deterrence are namely in how it conceives of how we undertake this project of pursuing crime reduction. One is, I think, that there's what I call the problem of the geography of crime. It's thought that the way to deter offenders is to put people in prison and punish them effectively, as if crime is something that only happens outside prison walls, which isn't true. Another problem is a problem of difference, that deterrence is about sending out some kind of threat, but the communication of the threat can be received very differently by different people, and it's hard to control the message to ensure that deterrence could take place. But there is a larger problem, perhaps, which is deterrence is while it might make we might be intuitively convinced that a certain kind of offense might deter people, it's very difficult to see how we could have any empirical evidence that people are deterred. So a common example I use with my students in Durham and where I've lectured elsewhere is to say, right, everybody, so how many people were almost deterred from stealing a bicycle today coming to class because of the fear of the threat from the necessary, related act pertaining to the theft of bicycles, that had some kind of motivation for you. And of course, no one knows what that could be or could probably know what that could be. So there's issues about whether or not we could ever know that anyone has been deterred. Of course, we can measure how crime rates might change over time, and we can try to come up with some view as to what might be the causes for that or not. But deterrence has a real problem about whether or not it's actually working or not. Moving then swiftly to rehabilitation, the third view I consider in this first part of the book. Rehabilitation, of course, the view that the aim of punishment should be the rehabilitation offenders. Rehabilitation also gets something right. I mean, I think it's very important to highlight this, that I think each gets something fundamentally right, which is why they've got adherents, why people defend these views. Rehabilitation adherents get right the fact that almost all offenders are one day going to be released. And if they're going to be released, do we want them to become better offenders? Do we want them to be people who don't reoffend? And the rehabilitation theory of punishment says that it's very important to engage in this process of individual reformation. They run into several problems that I look at in the book. One problem they have, of course, is the problem about unreformable persons and issues about civil disobedience. Another is a problem of treating like cases alike. So it might be if you've got two people who committed very similar offenses, but one is more quick to admit that, oh, I made a big mistake and be more generally, I won't do that again. Is that person released more quickly than the other by days, months, years than the other, because the other might take more rehabilitation or should seemingly less serious offenses be punished much more greatly because the offenders are more difficult to rehabilitate and so on. And then finally, I turn to a view called restorative justice. In older books looking at on the theories of punishment, this view or this kind of perspective might have been called abolitionism, the idea of that a kind of a non-prison response to crime. Restorative justice is broadly speaking the idea that it's a defense of a non-traditional way of thinking about how we should deal with crime. Instead of the trial, instead of sentencing, and the thought is that trials are formalistic. People feel very alienated. It's not clear that justice is happening for a variety of people, witnesses, victims, and others. And also, it's not clear with sentencing that it has the effects that its proponents claim, the good effects that its proponents say it should. Restorative justice says that instead we should have an informal process rather than a formal process, sometimes a victor-offender mediation with a facilitator or some kind of small conference setting where the victim and members of the community perhaps try to make the case to the offender about why you know, what effect that crime had on them. And the offender has a chance to kind of better understand the damage that he or she did, but also the end result is a kind of a contract where the offender agrees to, well, one, it's premised upon the offender apologizing to the victim, not through a solicitor, but through his or her own words, and many victims claim that that is very powerful. A second thing is that often there's some kind of community sentence, so there's some kind of good work in the community that is required of one kind or another. And also there's a payment of reparation of some kind made often agreed with victims. That to go forward must be agreed by the offender. If not, they then go to the formal process. Restorative justice also has a lot of things going for it. Namely, it can say the following. Look, this approach has been proven to have higher satisfaction rates, not just for offenders, who, of course, we might expect will be delighted to have no genuine possibility, at least at the first instance, of going to prison and avoid a trial, but also much higher satisfaction rates for victims themselves. Another thing it seems to get right is much improved crime reduction. So it seems to be more effective in the cases it's been used. And another thing it's done, it's been able to do this at much lower cost than alternatives. So one study in the United Kingdom showed that for every pound spent on restorative justice, you saved about £9 through traditional sentencing. So it's got an awful lot right, as it were, going for it. But what I, some criticisms I raise about why we should hesitate before we all jump on and support restorative justice is to say, well, what is being restored? Different proponents of restorative justice have different views upon what is being restored, whether it be some kind of moral relation between us and them, or whether it's some kind of idea about moral standing or other things. It's not quite clear what exactly is being restored. And more centrally, the idea of, as it were, trying to restore an unequal moral standing between me and you, between fellow citizens and the offender, well, there might be unequal standing before an offense happened anyway. And if the idea of equal standing is very important for restorative justice proponents, as perhaps rightly it should be, then we don't need people to be performing crimes to have that view. So there's some issues about what is being restored and the role that should and play. The other issues I raise are with its limits, that its success and other things that is going for it. It's often used for youth offenders and for minor offenses, and to some degree, it hasn't really been tested properly. And I question whether or not prison should be part of restorative process. And perhaps we'll talk later about this idea of punitive restoration, where I think that some kind of more punitive element should and can be incorporated in restorative justice. So these are the broad views of retribution, deterrence, rehabilitation, restorative justice, and why these views have been attractive to so many people, and I think for some very good reasons, but also why I think that runs into some serious problems that should make us hesitate before we join their camp.
Well, fantastic. Now I note that after dealing with these traditional longstanding kinds of views, you take up more recent views, and in particular, you take up three, including because mm-hmm. you include your own as a mixed theory. So you take up two other mixed theories, though. One is the a pair of views that I suspect many of our listeners will be familiar with. One view associated with Rawls and the other associated with HLA Hart. Mm-hmm. Let's skip over those. I take it that the short answer is that the Rawls view and the Hart view, in being mixed theories, inherit the problems with the views that they mix. Mm-hmm. Now there is an additional kind of mixed view that you take up that I would like to hear more about, because it seems like it's one of the newcomers on the scene. Mm. And it's called expressivism. Can you tell us about expressivism and why you think it is insufficient?
Yes, what you say is absolutely right. So I've already talked about part one. Now we turn to part two and the hybrid theories. I looked at the Rawls and Hart view in mixed theory. I should just say quickly, in part because I thought it was an important view to note, not least because it's the views of Rawls and Hart that have some broad overlap. But of course, one of the problems with it is that it has, I think, very few sincere adherents for that view. Expressivism is a view that if you look closely enough, you can find, there's a famous quote of a Victorian judge about punishment is like a stamp that seals the hot wax of public sentiment and anger about what somebody did. But expressivism is basically a view, I think more recently we can attribute to Joel Feinberg, and has found greater expression in the work of people like Anthony Duff and others in what they call a communicative theory. And the expressivist view of Feinberg is to say that punishment has, amongst other things, an expressivist component, or it ought to have an expressivist component, in order to justify the use of what he calls hard treatment or imprisonment. And this is, of course, the idea that punishment is not simply a view about we as a community say this is illegal and versus other things, but it's a view that gives expression to certain kind of values that are shared in the community. It's a punishment is an expression of public denunciation about the views that we do. So when we punish someone, it's as if we're shouting to someone, you know, hey, you, we don't like what you did. And the more we dislike what they did, the louder we shout, corrective, the more we punish. So the more severe the punishment, the more we denounce what they do, the greater the expression that we don't like what they did. I've included in this chapter the communicative theory, and I think we can talk about them together. So the communicative theory by Anthony Duff, John Tassioulis, and several others, as you say, kind of the other, you know, other than perhaps my view, the other kind of newcomer on the scene, and very popular with a lot of people for lots of good reasons. Again, I'm very sympathetic to lots of these views, which is why I think they should all come together in a unified view. But the communicative view says very roughly that with Feinberg, you know, the idea that the punishment just merely expresses we don't like what you did is, there's a communication going one way, but there should be some communication coming back from the offender, some kind of apology back from the offenders. There should be something expressed both ways, ultimately, in punishment. And how this is then a hybrid mixed theory is that, say, for Duff, when we are expressing our condemnation, we're giving a view about, we're only punishing people because they deserve it, so we're giving some expression to what people deserve. The thought is that when we give this expression about what we think people should deserve through hard treatment, this is this loud call that we utter should deter, be a kind of provide some kind of general deterrence to others we take this seriously and we enforce this threat, and also it's supposed to have this kind of reformative moment. So the thought that when I'm an offender and I'm in prison, that in being in prison, I communicate something back. I'll say something about this in a second. This is supposed to lead to, more often than not, some kind of rehabilitation of the offender. So it's supposed to speak to desert, deterrence, and rehabilitation to some degree or another. So what I think it gets right is surely punishment in all its forms, from very broadly speaking, from the fixed fine you might get for parking in the wrong place on campus to the death sentence we might receive for being convicted of murder, from all these different ranges, it's clear, at least in a metaphorical sense, yes, our punishment is a you know, it's a way of community saying, hey, we don't like what you did. If they liked what we did, we wouldn't be fined. We wouldn't have community service. We wouldn't have had a verbal warning. We wouldn't have been sent to prison. So metaphorically, at least, yes, of course it has this expressive moment. But what I question several things here is, one, I wonder what genuine work expressivism does in the justification of punishment. Because at the end of the day, when we look closely at Feinberg's view, and even when we look closely at Duff's views and other communicative theorists, at the end of the day, it's not about public denunciation. You know, the public denounces lots of things. The public doesn't like different minority groups. It doesn't like immigrants. It doesn't like lots of different things. We don't necessarily, you know, no expressivist or communicative theorist says we then go out and punish people because the community wants to denounce what they're like or who they are or other kinds of things. No, expressivism and denunciation are limited to only those cases where people deserve, and also within this boundary of what is deserved. And I think I claim that expressivism and communicative theories ultimately really boil down to a retributivist story about what people deserve and in proportion to what is deserved. And I'll also say something in particular with the communicative theory, the idea that so the communicative view of expressivism says that expressivism should be more than just the state saying, we don't like what you did, but the offender saying from his or her prison cell, I'm sorry to you for what I did. Here you have, what is the communication that offenders are giving us? Well, it turns out on most stories that this communication is nothing more than the poor person serving their prison sentence, of course, coerced without, not out of choice. They need not do anything. They need not actually apologize to satisfy the demands of what Duff will call secular penance. And I just find much of it kind of metaphorical and not really doing much of the work that it claims it does. So on the one hand, I think expressivism gets something right about punishment. Surely is a kind of denunciation, it is, at least to some degree. It's hard to disagree with that, I think. But it's not quite clear what deep work it's doing, because at the end of the day, when we try to see where it might depart in certain ways from a standard retributivist story, I couldn't find anything. I certainly couldn't find anything obvious. And then before that chapter, I do talk about Rawls' Hart and mixed theory, in part just to show a kind of a first contemporary attempt to bring together different views. But as you say, I do argue that it basically inherits many of the problems that they try to overcome.
Right. And this seems to be just to make a more general philosophical point, this does seem to be a standing problem philosophically with what we might think of as Goldilocks views, right? You know, philosophers sort of come along after philosophers have been arguing about something. There are three or four views on the table. Somebody has the bright idea, and it is a bright idea. Well, let's try to get what's good in each of these and leave behind what's bad in each of these. Sure. So you get hybrid views in all kinds of areas of philosophy. And the standing problem is always you've put together a nice view, taking the good and leaving the bad of each of the competitors, but there's still always going to be the question of the prioritization of the component parts, right? Which of these commitments is driving the others? Because then it looks as if, as you just said about the expressivist and communicative views, that they're really being driven by the retributivist insight, and the others are kind of riders or adjuncts. It looks as if, as your argument runs, these expressivist views are really just retributivisms dressed up in a more ecumenical garb, an attempt to sort of be retributivist, but hold on to what's good and everything else. Mm-hmm. Now, I take it though that you want to claim of your own view, the unified theory, that it doesn't suffer from this sort of Goldilocks kind of problem.
That's right. And it is the case that I think that, one of the things I want to do is show, I think that communicative theories and others are I want to show the emperor in his clothes. So I think that's right. I would say all those things about that view.
Right. But I take it that the unified view, though, is not an attempt to make a hybrid of the other competing views.
Right.
So it's not Goldilocks. It's an attempt to put together in a single theory of punishment what the competing views see as the, and as you, what you accept as legitimate aims of punishment, right? Yes. That is, the unified theory is trying to unify the different penal aims rather than to unify the different theories of the nature of punishment.
That's right.
So it's a hybrid in one sense, but it's not hybrid in the other. It's not a hybrid theory of punishment. Mm-hmm. It's a single theory of punishment that has a pluralistic or hybrid view of the aims of punishment. Does that sound right?
That's absolutely right and very well said. And it was also the cause for some delay in this book, because I wanted to not just survey what people had said and hoping to raise new objections, new issues, which I hope to have done with all other theories of punishment that I consider. But I wanted to also offer something positive, so not just kind of criticize others for what they said, but also say something about what I think they ought to have said, what kind of view they could have defended. One thing that has struck me about debates over theories of punishment is that there's a way in which these things go. And the way these things go is that you choose your favorite view and you dig in deeper and deeper. And so the retributivists and the deterrence proponents, they are in particularly deep. The rehabilitation proponents are almost as deeply dug in. And there hasn't been as, you know, much rapprochement or much attempts to try to really genuinely bridge different views. And I wanted to do something about that, not least because, as I say, I think each of these views has got something right. The trick was trying to see or trying to conceive how that could be done, how I could bring together, in a sense, retribution, deterrence, and other views in a way that could avoid these many objections. How could I have my cake and eat it too? And of course, you know, some people have tried to do it, like Rawls Hart at Hart, others of trying to say, well, different principles come into the story at different stages. Or, you know, different times in thinking about sentencing. What I ultimately did was try to reconceive the framework. So one way, sort of focus on the different theories, not focusing so much on the theories, as you say, but focusing on the aim. So I'm not trying to, the unified theory is not unifying retributivism, deterrence. And also, I should say, I apparently can say retributivism faster than anybody. So retributism, you know, when you work on punishment long enough, these things roll off the tongue. But not so much bringing together the theories, which, of course, this incoherence problem is one I think is difficult, if not impossible, to overcome. But instead try to bring together what's attractive about each of these views. So what's attractive about, say, retribution is not that it's, I don't know, retribution. It's this idea about some kind of idea of desert, that we're not punishing innocent people is doing something, and that there should be some kind of link between what someone did and then how we punish that individual. Deterrence gets right. Well, you know, who knows? As I say, you know, what is the what is the data on whether or not deterrence works? But what it gets right is this idea of crime reduction. So think about the aim of crime reduction and rehabilitation. And restorative justice, and thinking about this restoration process, what are the things that view gets right? And try to bring together the different principles that drive each of these theories, not the theories themselves, but these different principles that drive them, and try to create, in a sense, a new framework by which they can exist. And so what I do in this unified theory, how I try to unify these, is under a framework of thinking about rights, thinking about crimes as violations of rights, that punishment is a response to crime that tries to address this problem. And in a sense, the more sensual our rights are, you know, perhaps a difficult thing to work out. But the more central or fundamental our rights are, the more a response is necessary. And using that as a kind of general model for thinking through how crime reduction and other elements might play a role.
All right, so let's dig a little bit deeper, if that's okay. So it seems like the central plank of the unified theory is this this point that you were just speaking about, which is punishment is the restoration of rights, or punishment is the means by which rights are restored.
Hegelian idea.
Well, that's exactly right. Let me ask, at various points in the book, you refer to rights as substantive freedoms. Yes. So can you just fill in a little bit? And I take it that this is also a part of your view, which is influenced by Hegel. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about this conception of, you know, so punishment is the restoration of rights, and rights, I take it you hold, are substantive freedoms. Could you tell us about that conception of rights?
Yes. Well, there's much to be said about this. So one issue I became, I was very aware of is, you know, if I were to say that, what punishment is, you know, punishment is justified as a response to crimes. Then I've got a kind of potentially deeply problematic conservatism happening here. So I don't want to say punishment is justified in response to any crime. I want to say that that the crime is to be justified itself. And one thing I think perhaps novel about this, or something that hasn't been said by most commentators working on the philosophy of punishment, to my great surprise, is that punishment and crime, there's a link intrinsic about justice between the two. So often discussions about the justification of punishment happen almost independently of what the crimes are that these punishments are for. And I wanted to say that there must be some kind of link between them. There could not be a just punishment for an unjust crime. And that then raises the question of, all right, Tom Brooks, thank you very much for that deep penetrating insight. So what kinds of things should count as crimes and which things should not? And of course, to do that is itself a massive project, thinking through what, you know, criminalization, itself a huge minefield requiring a book at least as long as the one that I wrote. But what I wanted to do is, yes, say this, I have this idea about fundamental freedoms, because what I wanted to do, what I had in mind here, in terms of the kinds of rights motivating me, is I wanted to satisfy at least two different kinds of views about freedom that I find persuasive. I'm still working through for myself which one I like the most, so I wanted to have a view that was agreeable to both. One is you'll be unsurprised, because I know we know each other, and I know you know my views. You'll be unsurprised here about both of them. One view is the view of Martha Nussbaum, whose work has been very influential on me in many ways, even though she doesn't write much about punishment. She has, and certainly has written a lot about freedom and rights through the capabilities approach. And I wanted to, you know, so one way of thinking about, well, what do you mean by the fundamental freedoms that that are protected by the criminal law? This idea that the law is giving protection to rights. Well, what's doing the work here? Well, one thing would be that which is consistent with a capabilities approach. Very broad, but to give just a little, not much, but just give you a little flesh on the bones. The other view that I find persuasive, but am not an adherent yet of either, is the Republican theory of Philip Pettit, which I find very compelling, but still not yet in that camp. And of course, that's a view, right, that we're free where we're, say, not dominated.
Right.
And I'm, of course, convinced by work you've done and others that has been critical of raising real issues about that view as well. I wanted to, put it this way. These are two different views about what could be subsidy freedoms that could qualify, that speak to the kinds of things that rights are protecting, the kinds of fundamental freedoms that could be respected by anything the capabilities approached by Martha Nussbaum would accept, or anything that a Republican theory that Pettit would have would accept. And I think broadly many others. So, you know, you give me a substantive view about freedom that you find acceptable. Okay, let's use that for thinking about, so the criminal law will give protection to those rights, the rights that you think protect the things you think are fundamental freedoms that are acceptable to you. And I will then show you that the unified theory is on balance best for going forward with this. So I'm indicative in the book of the kinds of things I mean by fundamental freedoms. So I think I've got a long footnote about the capabilities and republicanism in the book. I didn't want to pin myself down to one particular view about the things that which are fundamental freedoms, in part because I wanted to keep my focus, one, on punishment, not get into a much longer debate about what is the nature of freedom and how does this work, and that could take me far beyond issues of punishment. And I also didn't want people to be too critical of what I say about punishment because of my particular views that I might or might not endorse ultimately on freedom. But rights does have an important role. So I'm not saying rights can be anything. I think that rights have to be protecting fundamental freedoms. I'm indicative of two different views that I think would be certainly acceptable for what I want to say, but I'm very clear that I don't think that list of capabilities in republicanism is somehow exhaustive of all the different views about freedom and rights and other things that could be acceptable here for my view. I want to be open to that, at least for now, for my present purposes, and then say, look, so it's not a conservative view that any old view about freedoms and rights can be criminalized. I give some very vague sphere, admittedly. Right. And I also don't want to say any old thing we want to criminalize. I want to say, no, not any thing we criminalize. Not anything can be criminalized. If crimes have to satisfy this threshold of protecting some kind of rights and understood and at least that very, very bare minimum sense. And I think whatever view we would find acceptable would at least satisfy that and probably and surely go more far beyond that and in a more robust sense. But that's what I was getting at in the background picture.
I see. So one of the sort of driving commitments, I think, of the unified theory is this conception of the stakeholder society. And in particular, some of the things you say indicate that, crime itself might be understood as the kind of outcome of people feeling insufficiently invested in the fate of their communities.
Yes.
At other points, you say that punishment has to serve this purpose, or it has to serve this aim of helping to reestablish or to help offenders realize the stake that they have in the health of their society. So it looks as if this idea of stakeholding plays a large role in this unified view. So maybe that might be a good way to tell us first about the idea of stakeholding and then spell out this conception of punishment from the unified theory's view that follows out of that conception of having a stake in one society.
Excellent. Well, the stakeholding does have an important role to play. So as I say, I think that the justification of punishment, I think, has some kind of link with crime and the criminal law, and likewise with some kind of broader normative, as it were, background. Not just any old laws or crime should count, but some kind of general picture. And what led me to think about stakeholding was in the case studies in the book look at the death penalty, look at juvenile offending, look at domestic violence, and look at there's a chapter on sex crimes, looking at rape and child sex offenders, and each looks at how different theories of punishment respond, perhaps surprisingly, differently to these different cases. And a few words about why I thought the unified theory handled them best. And this idea of stakeholding really comes up. You know, one good example where it comes up in a real essential way is in juvenile offending, youth offending. So with youth offending, what I look at there in particular is I focus on, there's a lot of efforts made to identify so-called risk factors. So what is it that, you know, what are the risk factors associated with youth offending? This is wildly important because the, you know, an overwhelming number of people who are, the overwhelming majority of people who are offenders are people who are either presently youth offenders or have been youth offenders. So tackling youth offending is not just a way of reducing crime by youth, but it's also a way of addressing crime overall and over time. And so you see lots of different stories about how we should identify the risk factors. And the common ones for youth and for adults are things like unemployment, financial insecurity, housing insecurity. And you can see what these ideas of employment and finance and housing, there's overlap, right? So if you don't have much, if you don't have employment, then you might have financial insecurity, you might have housing insecurity. But these are each identified separately. Also having negative networks, support networks. So having unhealthy, abusive relationships at home or amongst friends or lack of that, you know, being alone and disconnected, that these are various risk factors. And so the traditional way of thinking about youth offending and other kinds of offenders is to identify what these risk factors are and then to tackle each one, as it were, kind of independently. And so if you know, unemployment is an issue associated with offending, so the, you know, so the thought is if you have higher unemployment, then you are on balance will have higher offending. So what you want to do is create jobs. It's not just good economic sense, it's good criminal justice policy. If housing insecurity is an issue, that the more people are having trouble maintaining some kind of regular home, or a place they can call home, then the more likely they might be to offend. Then the thought is, well, doing something about how these housing issues, it's not just good housing policy, it's also good criminal justice policy, and so on. I'm sure you see where I'm going with that.
Sure.
And so the idea of stakeholding is to say something substantive about, well, what's doing the work? So is it just kind of this hodgepodge, this kind of collection of different things out there that just so happen to be associated, and we address a little bit of this and a little bit of that, a bit of bat wing and mole bone and I don't know what in this witch's brew, and then we'll somehow have this kind of good effect. And of course it is the case that, you know, when we tackle unemployment, you do often see reductions in employment, but not always. When you tackle the things, you do see this. And so you can see how that cycle has been why it's continued. But what I argue is that stakeholding is important. Where I get this idea is from perhaps an unconventional place. It's from Hegel's philosophy of right.
Right.
In Hegel's philosophy of right, he thinks that one of the big problems for modern society in 1820 is the problem of poverty, or the problem of the rabble. And the idea is that in society, there's a group of people that are often but not always at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder, and that these people are disconnected to society, that they look to society as an other, that the laws of society and its institutions are things that are part of the lives of other people, not part of their lives. And so they're disconnected and they act contrary to this. So they act without regard to the rest of society. And Hegel sees this as a deeply problematic source of not just crime, but much, much deeper problems for the continuation of a just society, or put in Rawlsian in terms of problem for political stability, is the existence of a rabble. Crucially for Hegel, the rabble, it's not just about material wealth. It's not just people at the bottom. It's also at the very bottom. It's also people at the very top. And so one of the things I want to say about the rabble, I think the rabble is Hegel's discussion of the rabble is actually very useful for thinking about how we should understand risk factors in a kind of with a more coherent approach. And that is, for Hegel, the problem is a problem of a state of mind. The problem of the rabble is that they see themselves as not being well, in Hegel's terms, not being recognized by others. But, you know, recognition has got baggage in philosophy and elsewhere. It can mean lots of different things, evokes lots of different thoughts of lots of different philosophers, some of whom people are just perhaps naturally opposed. So I wanted to kind of have my own language. And so I borrow a phrase. Tony Blair, Prime Minister of Britain, borrowed this idea of the stakeholder economy from Will Hutton, this idea that the problem of the market is that it's not transparent enough, it's not open enough, and people ought to see themselves as having a stake in it. And I changed stakeholder economy to stakeholder society and say that that what Hegel's getting at with the rabble is that people do not see themselves as having a stake in society, and that is what's doing the work. You often see, so the problem with folks who are, the risk factors of unemployment or housing insecurity and financial insecurity and others isn't so much that they are unemployed or that they have problems with housing and others, because lots of people have these problems and don't offend. So why is it that some are perhaps at higher risk than others? What explains this? And what also explains why many of these risk factors overlap? Not all are about monetary wealth. Some are about support networks and other kinds of things. And I think part of it is this mindset of seeing yourself or oneself as not having a stake in society, and the importance of seeing yourself in society. And then, of course, the importance of society being a place in which you should want to have a stake. So it's not a conservative view and a sense of just saying, looking to your state and saying, hey, this is my state, I should grin and bear it. And, the state has to have these normative, fulfill these normative aspirations itself. It can't just be any old kind of a place. But there's this importance of this being a place in which you want to have a stake. And this is, of course, I think makes a lot of sense. And there's a hypothesis in the book that people who don't have these risk factors, of course, what might explain why they're not offending is that they do see themselves as having a stake. So those who are employed, who have pension plans, who are paying their mortgages, or aspire to be employed and have mortgages and have pensions and other kinds of things, are people who look to the system as a place or a kind of a sphere in which they want to relate to others, in which they want to be a part, in which problems are to be resolved within the system, within the game, and not without. And that is an important thing for thinking about risk factors, thinking about stakeholding, and not in terms of these isolated risk factors that can look like lists that don't have any kind of content or unity or something. So I try to say something about that. And the relationship, as it were, for punishment is, as I say, this idea of the society as a stakeholder society, a society in which we should all want to or should be able to see ourselves as having a stake, is this kind of broad indication of this kind of broad background of justice that helps inform the view, I think, about criminal law and punishment that all kind of fit together. Because I don't think punishment can be thought of separately from criminal law, separately from these wider considerations. And principally, though, stakeholding plays a role for two things. One, it plays a role in helping identify, helping us think through these risk factors, as I've already said, But the other thing I think it helps us do and helps inform is self-thinking about how we could rethink punishment. So this unified theory about bringing together different principles, one question is why the heck do it? And the other is, what does it look like? And then perhaps the third is a maybe a brief historical thing I might just say very briefly. Mm-hmm. So one, why think this stuff in the first place? Well, when we look away from much of the work by philosophers on punishment, when we look to the literature by people who on sentencing policy itself, we discover all kinds of things. One, that 1962, there was a model penal code. The model penal code was wildly, in the United States, wildly influential in the U.S. For the very good reason that each of the 50 states had their own views about what was murder, what was theft. There was inconsistency in how this was understood and how it was sentenced. And the model penal code was a was an attempt to think through, however badly and problematic as it is, it was an attempt to think through how there could be some kind of broad overlap, so there could be some consistency amongst the 50 states. And it had some good effect. And one of the things it does is it says that there are multiple purposes for sentencing, including retributivist desert, that so punishment should be deserved. It should have an eye towards deterrence. It should have a view towards public safety. It should try to enable the rehabilitation of offenders where it can, and so on. Of course, there isn't much said in the model penal code as just a code, not an elaborate philosophical defense about how these different purposes for punishment can be brought together. But this idea that punishment should be, a sentencing policy should be based around different, this kind of what I call penal pluralism, different purposes for punishment, is something that's been around for several decades. Model penal code was very influential in the United States. Most states now have sentencing guidelines. All sentencing guidelines that exist express these different purposes for sentencing in their guidelines. They're also present in the federal sentencing guidelines. Those states that do not yet have sentencing guidelines, like my home state of Connecticut, they do have a sentencing guidelines commission meeting right now. And one of the things they're doing in their brief is to come up with guidelines that satisfy multiple purposes for sentencing. And this is not just an American kind of thing. It's been exported. So in England and Wales, which is a single jurisdiction in criminal law in the UK, also Scotland and elsewhere, the sentencing guidelines that exist for these countries also has expressly in England and Wales five purposes for sentencing. And these incorporate the different principles that I try to express in my unified theory. And so, why think these kinds of things? Well, one is that when we turn to what judges actually do in the real world, it turns out it's very different from much of the stuff that is defended by many philosophers, that the practice for 50 years for many jurisdictions has been, or at least other places for several decades, has been this kind of hybrid, bringing together different purposes. But where the practices have had a problem, that there hasn't been any kind of robust way of thinking about how they could be, how they should come together, or why this and that purpose and not other purposes. So my unified theory wants to say something about how you could unify different purposes, but also why these. And I say why desert, a particular view about desert and crime reduction and others, is because these are all about the protection of rights. So what we want to do, if crimes are violation of rights and punishments, I understand them as responses to crimes, then punishment aims at a restoration of rights, a protection of the rights that have been infringed or violated through crimes. And crime reduction in other ways are great principles for thinking about how we could do it. So in some sense, I'm trying to provide a philosophical defense for practices that are longstanding in the United States, mm-hmm. The United Kingdom, and elsewhere for many years. I then try to give some indication of what this might look like in practice with an idea I call punitive restoration, or which I see giving expression to a restoration of rights view. So I say lots of good things about restorative justice, and there's many good things to say about it. So this, again, is a meeting of victims, where victims are willing and where there are victims. Not every crime has a victim or individual victim. Sometimes the victim is all of us, you might say, or just actually right. The victim might be the offender. Bringing together victims where relevant, the offender, and sometimes members of the community to discuss the have a constructive dialogue about why the offense happened, what effect these offenses had on people that it did, and what would be the best ways of tailoring the offense to address the problems that the crime gave rise to. And this approach has been very successful at improved crime reduction rates. It's done all the kinds of things the unified theory ought to do. The people, the offenders have to admit guilt for the procedure to start. So there's an element of desert happening, but without all the kind of baggage about bringing in certain kinds of issues about morality, I think, or natural law, I find problematic with many retributivist accounts. So there's an element of desert happening. The punishment, the response, is tailor-made to address the problem of the crime in the context in which it happens. So you have this in proportion to the offense. There's a clear effort at crime reduction that has been achieved. Some studies show that restorative justice has shown improvements, about 25% less crime, less recidivism than alternative models. So it achieves crime reduction. It enables rehabilitation, often written into the restorative contracts agreed at these conferences. Are the offender will take some kind of drug and alcohol treatment or cognitive behavior therapy, or engage in employability skills training and so on, and also engage in some kind of reparation to offenders. So many of the boxes that I want to tick with the unified theory, many of the purposes for punishment seem to be addressed by the restorative view. But the problems I had with the restorative view were, again, well, what is being restored? And you have all these different views about, well, it's unequal standing between you and me and self and other and all this other stuff, which I found wildly unconvincing and so on, for reasons like inequality between the standing of different peoples can exist independently of whether or not they've committed any offense and so on. So what's specific about this offense that gives rise to the inequalities that punishment ought to address? And I thought the thing to be restored is not necessarily moral standing as such, but though I think that's also something worthy of addressing for a wider view about justice and distributive justice. But instead, the restoration of rights and the rights violations. We should have a kind of focus about that. So what is to be restored is the rights that have come threatened by the criminal actions by offenders. And that encompasses, it's wide enough to include all the kinds of things we want to include, namely people who've done criminal offenses, but it's not so wide to include other kinds of things, namely, you know, kind of non-offenses or non-violations of rights. But it also addresses this issue about stakeholding. So if it's important that society be a place in which I have a stake, and that this idea is a view about justice, it's not just a wish, but it's something that should be really kind of, in some sense, kind of rolled out, then I think that the restorative framework can do this. And of course, you see that victims and offenders claim that they have higher satisfaction rates in using restorative conferences versus alternatives. It's not surprising why, because here they can see that they have a stake in the proceedings. They are able, you know, the offender is able to give some expression to why he or she did what they did, and the victim is able to speak to the damage that inflicted, and also they can all be in a dialogue about what they think should happen. Likewise, members of the local community, as it were. So I think that some say the jury might be, the jury trial is a kind of mini parliament, a mini democracy. And I think, well, using running along with metaphors, perhaps this idea of restorative justice might be a kind of miniature stakeholder society. But I go further, and I think that restorative justice views, they rule out, on the whole, the use of a prison, say that, you know, restoration just doesn't happen in prisons. I think that is probably misconceived. It's probably untrue that, it's probably, is, I'm sure it is the case, that restoration is highly unlikely. People are you know, all, when people go to prison, they often come back much worse. Prison can be a bad place for many people, but also it can be a very constructive place, actually, for a lot of people, because a lot of offenders are engrossed in highly negative support networks, and it could be important to have a kind of cooling off period. And also, you know, when people find themselves doing crimes for which sentencing is an option, it's often not the first time that there's problems in that person's life that he or she could be helped with. It's often a confirmation of longstanding issues. And I think that prison can be a place that should be used, not for as long as it is. It could be used very differently. And I try to give some ideas about how prison could be used more innovatively to enable restoration in short but intensive ways that can bring about restoration. And I call this punitive restoration, that it's thinking about restoration not just in terms of treatment programs and community sentencing and reparations to victims, but also as possibly also incorporating some kind of brief term in prison. I think that that could be likely. And what would be good about that, I'll just add, is also making restorative justice more applicable to more cases, because restorative justice isn't really, in a sense, a theory about justice the way it is presented, because it's only used for minor offenses by minors. It's not something that anyone generally endorses for more violent offenses. And I think with some interesting differences with domestic violence, some people think restorative justice is the way to go with domestic violence. Others have other starkly different views. So it's a way to try to roll out restorative justice more, a way of bringing the public in to thinking about sentencing, which I think could be a good thing. But the bringing the public in an informed way through engagement in the restorative conference setting or the punitive restorative framework that I outlined. Can I just say one last word here about sure. historical roots? Yeah, good. I've said all this, and we've had a wonderful conversation that I knew I would enjoy thoroughly and of course, have. But I was able to do all of this without really saying a whole lot about Hegel and right. British idealism. And that was also a purpose of the book. John Rawls says many good things. One of the good things he says in the beginning of A Theory of Justice is that you know, he claims no originality for his views, that he's basically taking old wine and he's putting it in new bottles. He's resetting old arguments in new ways to bring out their full force, that there's a lot of good things that Rousseau and Kant and Hume had to offer, and he's going to show us how we can bring these things together in a new way, in a distinctive way, to bring widespread support. And that is exactly what I had in mind here. The philosophers that had a very huge role in the background of my thinking is Hegel and the British idealists. Hegel, of course, will be familiar to listeners, no doubt, but why I have him in mind may be less clear. Hegel says a comment around page 465, a place that not many people get to, I dare say, in the science in the science of logic. Yes, I think an argument in the science of logic is highly, reveals something very true about punishment. It gives an illustration of a view about philosophical grounding, which I won't get into. And the example is punishment. He says that the mistake people make is thinking that punishment is either retribution, deterrence, or rehabilitation. In fact, punishment is all three. Now, of course, Hegel would have to say something like that. And it's striking that, you know, no one has thought Hegel would say, you know, a guy who thinks, you know, the Trinity is at the heart of his philosophy in so many ways, and how his dialectic unravels, as some people might say, or develops, if you're more charitable, that he would try to think this three-in-one, not just about ideas about other issues of philosophy and religion and other things, but also about punishment. But of course, Hegel doesn't really say a whole lot about how that is to be cashed out and how it's to be developed. And I just had that tantalizing idea in the back of my mind. That was the first thought that got things running for me And ooh, this could be a distinctive way, a different way of thinking about punishment, that it's not separate. People get wrong with their different camps, but they really should be brought together. But I had no clear idea about how I could take that forward. Then enter into the picture British idealists. So British idealists are surely probably less familiar to many listeners, and they broadly are people like Bradley and T.H. Green, who some might have heard of, and others less familiar, like Bernard Bosanquet, who was originally from Northumberland, the area of Britain that I live in, and his family, of course, is actually still in Northumbria. And other people as well, like James Seth, who worked broadly in the 19th century or early 20th century, and folks like Collingwood and others, and what they were doing, or perhaps one of the things they were very famous for, other than being wrong. Of course, you know, they had a long line of critics of Bertrand Russell and others who, you know, they're probably most famous for being wrong in the eyes of many people. But one of the things that they were famous for and should be famous for is introducing to English language philosophy the work of Kant and Hegel. And that's exactly what they did. But also they tried to bring the work of Kant and Hegel together. Now, one of the things that... So there's an interest in looking at the British idealists, Bradley, Green, Bosanquet, Collingwood, Caird, Seth, and others, to learn more about early receptions of Kant and Hegel in a kind of historical way. But there's also, I think, another reason to have interest, that many of these philosophers, and I've spent a lot of time, a lot of work unpacking this, they seem to catch on to Hegel's three-in-one argument. So it is the case that Green and Bosanquet and others argue for this three-in-one view. They all say, those who do talk about punishment do say that punishment should not be conceived in terms of retribution or deterrence or rehabilitation, that these things are three-in-one. And it was within perhaps a more obscure British idealist named James Seth, who wrote a book on a study of ethical principles, a wonderful book, about 1890s, where he says that the way we should think about this was within a context of a rights framework. So I've taken a lot of these ideas about thinking about the protection of rights and the relationship between law and morality, law, morality, and punishment, how we might be able to bring together different purposes through this kind of background ideas about Hegel and British idealism. I think they get right that these views can be brought together, that it can be brought together through a rights framework, that it can be done, that there's something very attractive about this. But of course, the way I think they all did it was wrong. And so my way, what I wanted to do was have a book about punishment that defends a kind of a neo-British idealist view about punishment without itself getting into the metaphysics and all the other problems that those views are very well known for having. So there's some thoughts about the background. So why have a unified theory? Well, sentencing policy does it, and it's kind of surprising. A lot of philosophers haven't seemed to notice this in their work. How might it work? Well, it might work through this idea of punitive restoration that I set out, this modification about how restorative justice might work in theory and in practice. And also this wider idea of stakeholding and unification is built upon this framework. I didn't get it overnight, apple falling on my head. It hit me reading Hegel's Science of Logic. That's not something that a lot of people can say. And the work of some great British idealists that I also hope through the book to popularize. I hope to popularize interest in Green and Bosanquet and others more through the book as well as a kind of background project.
Well, Tom, thank you so much. You've been very generous with your time. And we've been talking about your book, Punishment, which is highly recommended. Thank you so much for joining us on New Books in Philosophy.
My great pleasure. And I'm so honored to have this chance to talk at some length about a project that is taking up my time, as I say, issues I've been grappling with since I was a graduate student and certainly continue to grapple with now.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to my interview with Professor Tom Brooks of Durham Law School. We were talking about his new book, Punishment, published by Routledge. I'm Robert Talese, your host. This is New Books in Philosophy. Thank you for listening.